Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Liam, I can't help noticing you do not appear to be wearing glasses this evening.
I do. I've just taken them off because I am tired.
Oh, okay. Sometimes you do take them off, but they tend to come off for like a minute or two at most. But we've been on this call now for more than 15 minutes and you haven't been wearing them.
So I was wondering
if you'd had like stealth LASIK or something.
No. I just didn't want to see you too clearly today. Your focus on your camera is crystal clear.
Yeah.
I've commented on the quality of your camera and lens before.
Yeah.
And right now I just needed to blur that out, so I had to take the glasses off.
Fair enough. Yeah. I guess I'll have to downgrade my camera.
Just a bit of jealousy from my side.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is the Beer Driven Devs, and there are other ways of blurring your vision.
That's right. Funnily enough, I've actually run out of beer.
Really?
Yeah. My kegs are empty. There's no beer in the fridge. So rather than the beer, I've gone for a Pinot Noir.
Oh, very nice.
From Adelaide Hills, yeah.
Oh, Adelaide Hills, yeah. Oh, not bad.
Yeah. And I noticed you're not drinking a beer either.
I am drinking a Lagavulin that I got for my birthday out of a Superman glass that I got for my birthday.
I did notice that glass, a very nice looking glass.
Mm.
Is that a new addition to the bar?
Yes. Yeah. So now we know for the recording what tonight's drinks are. Yeah. So you've got an Adelaide Hills Pinot and I have a Lagavulin.
Yeah, beautiful. So I think it might have been last week or the week before. I put a post up on LinkedIn that you commented on. And I think I've also got a longer form post somewhere around this idea for buying versus building. And particularly in software, right?
Yeah.
And you and I have had a little bit of back and forward. And I think there's something to just dig in a bit deeper. I think we can dig into that one a bit further.
Yeah. So this is actually something that we've spoken about before. And I'm pretty sure we have spoken about this topic potentially being a discussion for the podcast before as well.
Mm.
I'm just wondering if this is the post. This is from a week ago. No, so you do have one here from about a week ago, which is you're sitting on the buy versus build decision, trying to work out which to go. But I don't think that's the one, is it? Let me just look. Transformation.
It was.
This is it. This is one 4 weeks ago. Wow. Okay.
4 weeks ago.
Yeah. Liam Elliott, I spent years building software for large organizations, custom platforms. You found it?
Yeah. No, another one now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the premise of this post was, of your post here was, SMBs I talk to, the ones actually running businesses, 10, 20, 50 people, they assumed that kind of work wasn't for them. Too expensive, too complex. Something only corporates could afford. And I think what I refer to here is the bespoke software myth. And there's kind of two aspects to it, I think. There's two different angles from it that we're coming at it from. In your case, this post is talking about the gap between the viability for smaller businesses versus large enterprises to go down that bespoke pathway.
Yeah.
And I actually commented on it here as well with what I see as well, which is that, and this doesn't just affect small businesses, this affects large enterprises as well. But this belief that, in fact, let's park it, because there's two topics here. Let's talk about your angle first here. So why don't you talk me through, because you've mentioned that you kind of see this with the small businesses that you talk to. So why don't you talk me through what you see and what the problem is?
So as you mentioned, this post sort of starts out, I've spent years building software for large organizations, right? So yours, my experience is in what we sort of, you know, in air quotes, call the enterprise space.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've worked on teams and worked on projects with multi-million-dollar budgets, teams where, you know, made up of probably a half a dozen individual engineers on the team, plus project management, plus product owners, plus testing teams, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and the budget just gets blown straight out of the water. Now, there's a certain area of the market that can't afford that, obviously speaking, right? The SMB, that small, medium enterprise, can't afford to throw those resources to build these custom bespoke products. Now, from my perspective, that's really unfair, right? That's super unfair if you know, there's a mum and dad shop down the road that's trying to compete with the big end of town. They just can't. And I'm not talking about compete by making software. I'm talking about just compete in whatever business they want, whatever they're actually doing. If it is a professional services, say law firm, you know, just a smaller practice of, as I said in that post, like 10, 20 employees, will struggle to compete with one of those big name law firms because they just don't have the budget. Right? And those big name law firms have tools that have been built specifically for them. And I'm not just law firms, like that's just an example, right? It could be any professional services, it could be anything. But they've got tools built specifically for them to optimize their back office systems, to make everyone's life easier, to basically, and as I say to clients or potential clients, right? That's their secret sauce. That's what makes them stand out from their competition. That's what makes them competitive. And if the smaller end of town can't afford to do that, how can they expect to compete on that greater playing field?
Yeah.
So, you know, this post I posted this from my personal account, but it's something I'm seeing when I'm talking to potential clients. And, you know, I am myself a small business. And yeah, I'm competing with, you know, the large consultancies. I'm competing with the big four and everyone else, right? There's two parts to it, right? From a small business perspective, right? One side is a reputational side, right? So I can't compete with the Accentures, et cetera, because I just don't have the brand name, right? I don't have that experience I don't have that reputation to say, yes, we are more than capable to solve those problems. And that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the custom software that they've got running their systems, and it might not even be custom software, but it's the way that they've got their CRMs and their project management software and everything else all finely tuned and working for them. And they've got their own in-house team that has built the integrations to get everything working specifically that, as I said, like their secret sauce gets them humming along and keeps them well ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Right. And they've earned that right. Right. Generally, these companies, they're not small for a reason, and they've earned that right to build these tools. But from a business perspective and from an entrepreneur's perspective or even just a personal perspective, I want to see the little guy win.
Okay.
And that's where this post was coming from, right? I think there is a way that the smaller end of town can compete, not completely level playing field, but they should be able to flatten out that playing field for a far smaller budget. And I don't think it's as inaccessible as people realize.
Yeah, I think not only are you right, but I think actually that's their superpower. And we've spoken about this before. And I don't know if you remember, there was one example I gave where there was a client I was working with that actually spun off a small startup to disrupt themselves. Because the agility and innovation and novelty that a small, unconstrained organization can do far outstrips what a larger enterprise can do. So I think that's actually their superpower. And I agree that, so like, is it the title of my blog post here is the bespoke software myth. And it's more than one myth really, but I guess it's all part of the same myth. I don't know. But the message is clear, right? And that is smaller bespoke software, custom development is not for small businesses. And I think you and I both agree that message is misplaced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were coming at it from the angle here that the smaller businesses can't afford it, because the examples you're giving are these multi-million dollar, multi-year, massive development projects. But they don't all have to be like that. And I think some of the examples you often talk about in the posts that you share are things like, what about, you know, just this one little process that needs to be automated, or this little thing that will unblock your team? And there was something you posted today, which you really touched on something amazing, which is that you've got like business leaders and owners making decisions, but they're not the ones with the institutionalized knowledge, the frontline workers are. And you mentioned something adjacent to that today, and I think that's really important. So I agree. And I think, this is something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and we have spoken about a bit as well. So I wrote up this blog post, and I spoke about a few different aspects, including cost. The big one as well, by the way, that people often talk about is, oh, you need your own in-house development team, which is completely false. And I'll get back to that. But the big one for me, the main angle that I come at this from is risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the risk side of it doesn't just impact small businesses. It impacts everyone all the way up to your large multinational enterprises, because mm-hmm. they're all sold the same lie. Well, is it a lie? I mean, it's untrue, but perhaps it's not fair for me to call it a lie. But it's not true. They're sold the same misinformation. And that is about the risk of build versus buy, right? So there's this belief that if you buy commercial off-the-shelf software, it's lower risk than building custom software.
Mm-hmm.
And that is demonstrably untrue.
Yep.
And in fact, I won't necessarily talk about the research right now, but my blog post does link to a whole bunch of well-researched, well-backed evidence. Like there are some reports here from, I mean, there's a really great, well, that's about something else, but there's like the Panorama Consulting Group's ERP report, vendor lock-in risk, and there's some reports on this. I won't go through them all, but there's a few links here, which I think all paint the same picture, right? And this is the thing, right? So, and I'll tell you my perspective of having worked in some of these large enterprises and having worked with decision makers who have been afraid to go down the bespoke path because they don't understand it, right?
Yep.
And they think, therefore, it's higher risk. But they also don't understand the commercial software that they're buying and therefore don't understand the risk there either.
100%. So, sorry, just quickly, I just want to jump in there before this example gets irrelevant. Early on in my career, I was working for one of the national broadcasters, right? And we rebuilt their sales and ad scheduling platform. Now, when I started that program, and that was, again, this is one of those multi-million dollar, multi-year projects with massive teams, right? When they started that, they went and looked for off-the-shelf products. And yes, there are some. It's a very bespoke niche marketplace, but yes, there were some. But the thing was, they were paying million-dollar licensing fees and then still needed to pay a multi-million-dollar project to customize that software to their bespoke needs.
That's it. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. When you talk about risk in an enterprise context, you are usually talking about dollars, right? It's like, how much money is on the line here with this? How much do we stand to lose versus how much do we stand to gain?
Mm-hmm.
Versus what are we protecting? That's risk, right? When it comes to enterprise, right? Yep. Of course, there are other kinds of risks like workplace health and safety and what have you, right? But when we talk about risk in an enterprise context, we're talking about how many dollars are on the line, right? And this is absolutely right. I mean, you look at these big projects and these big large enterprise software rollouts, and they cost millions of dollars. And you know, there's the licensing cost, which, as you've noted, is very expensive. And then there's the consulting cost of paying someone to come and implement it for you. And then, of course, there's all the hidden costs because there's all the things they don't tell you. And again, like the number of projects I've been involved in, and not just large enterprise ones, these are across the board, right? Every sort of scale where a vendor has come in and they've put a price on the table and they've answered the questions, does your product do this, 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 and this? Yes. And then the contract is signed and they come in and the project starts and they say, okay, so now we're implementing this, this, and this. And the client says, but what about this, this, and this? And they say, oh, no, that's extra.
Yeah.
But you said your product does it. It does, but you have to pay extra for it.
Got to make sure you ask the right questions.
Yeah, exactly, right? But this is the thing is like most people don't necessarily know the right questions to ask. That question is often, does it meet these requirements? And the answer is yes. But then, what they should be asking is, does your proposal include everything that our requirements require at the price you're suggesting? Yeah. And like, this is the thing is, it sounds underhanded and sneaky, but that is actually, that's the way it's done. Like, if you think about what we do in bespoke, that we'd never get away with that, right? And that is just not a risk you have. You have a completely different risk, which is managing estimates and scope. And there's absolutely risk around that.
Yep.
But that's a different risk, right? Thing is actually with commercial off the shelf, you still have that risk too.
You do.
There is still, so, yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I think actually the risk is inverted. I actually think that the risk of building software is much, much lower than the risk of owning software. And I'll give you some more examples, right? Something else you mentioned was customization, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's assuming you can customize it. And even if you can, these organizations charge money. And like often it's, they don't do it, a partner does it, in which case you have to pay for it because that's literally their business model of these partners.
Yep.
Sometimes the vendor will do it, but they're still going to charge you for it. You're still beholden to their roadmap, their priorities, their backlog amongst all their other customers as well. You know, when it comes to bespoke, you don't have any of that. You get what you want when you want, in theory, right? But then there's more, right? Which is that, like, one of the biggest ones that always comes up around risk is, as I mentioned a minute ago, is this idea that if you're going to build, you need an in-house development team, which is absolutely untrue, right? You don't have an in-house development team for a vendor product. And granted, the vendor does have their own developers. But think about it this way, right?
Yeah, when but if you're doing a custom implementation and customization project, you wouldn't have an in-house development team. You'd have, like you said,
exactly.
There's a partner that's doing that for you.
Exactly. But here's where it gets much worse, right? On the commercial side. In the projects that you and I do, we go and build software for a client. And the first thing that we do is we say, all right, can we have access to your repo, to your source control system?
Yep.
Because they own the source code. Like, we build it for them. We build it on their platform. We build it on their system. We hand over the code.
Yep.
And if the client decides they don't like us and they want to find someone else, there is another you or another me, and there's 10 or 100 of us lining up to come and do the work that they need at an hourly rate rather than a 5-year lock-in multi-million dollar support contract. Of course, we would love those contracts, but yep. We're not going to turn down the work. And there are plenty of people that you can find to do it. And you own the code, right? Your commercial off-the-shelf vendor, what happens if they go under or get acquired or change their licensing or what have you, right?
And that's why I like this. I love this idea of the analogy for rent versus buy.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Right?
When you're renting, you're paying that weekly, monthly subscription fee. It's the same as renting a house.
Yeah.
Right? Look, I mentioned to you when I was looking at your article and I just, in a back channel, mentioned it, right? There are examples out there where, like you said, the platform decided they wanted to change their terms of service.
Yeah.
And basically said, we don't want you on our platform anymore.
Yeah.
And I think I sent it to you, but I think it could have been Shopify maybe or someone else basically turned around one day and said, we don't want any gun-related shops on our platform.
Yeah. So you did mention that to me, and I looked it up and I couldn't find anything. But I did find an actual example, which was Etsy. So about a year ago, Etsy changed their terms of service and they basically banned like a whole bunch of things. But yeah. One of the main ones was like 3D printed products.
Yep.
And that wiped out like thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of sellers.
And, you know, as an analog to this too, I know Scott Hanselman's mentioned this in the past. Own your words, I think he says. Right? You can be deplatformed at any point.
Yeah.
If you are working off the YouTube algorithm or the Instagram algorithm, and that is your main source of reach, you run the risk of being deplatformed.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about here is exactly the same thing.
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Right? It's exactly the same. If the owner of that platform does not want you on their model, on their platform, they can kick you off. They'll change their services.
Or if they decide to change what they do, you know.
Or, and I've said this in the past, right? Or they could bump up their monthly fees by 100%, 200%.
Yeah, which happens.
Granted, they could only do that once before everyone just bails on them.
Yeah.
But most organizations, if Salesforce were to turn around and say our prices are going to double next year, there are so many organizations that will have to just stomach that price rise.
Yeah.
Because they are so embedded on that platform that they cannot go to an alternative. And the cost to move is ridiculous.
And the irony is that Salesforce was the alternative.
Yeah. And that's it.
Yeah.
Right. And this is that rent versus buy analogy. And I just to take it that little bit further, right? The buying / building side of things, you're creating an asset for your brand, for your company. Right. If you're going to sell that company at one point down the track, this piece of software that you're building, and like in your article, like you say, like we're not rewriting Excel.
Yeah.
We're not talking about doing that. But if this is core to your business and it is, as I say, the secret sauce for your business, this is an absolute asset that is only adding value to your organization. It's not a liability that's coming out once a month.
And that's the key differentiator, right? And I'm glad you said it because I was going to say it. And that's the difference, right? Is a commercial off-the-shelf product is a liability and in more ways than one, right? So on the one hand, it's literally a liability in terms of you've got a licensing cost, you've got a maintenance cost, you have, assuming, let's say maintenance includes support, right? So, or not, right? But you've got, you know, you've potentially got hosting, you've potentially got licensing, you've potentially got maintenance, you've potentially got support, you've potentially got custom or bespoke development, but then you have that with your bespoke software anyway. So let's count that one out. But it's a liability, and it's a repeat liability. It's a recurring fee on your books, whether you pay it once a year or once every 5 years or what have you. It's exactly as you said, it's a liability, right? Yep. It's money that you have to pay. But in addition to that, it's a liability to your business, right? And this is something I speak about in the article, which is that commercial off-the-shelf software is by and large commoditized,
mm-hmm.
right? You can go to tender and you can look at the options that are out there and you can choose among them, or you can choose to do something bespoke, right? But it's very rare where you go to market and there's only one game in town. And I'm not sure I can think of any right now.
I think we're at the stage now where a lot of the common products, there's multiple options, like CRMs, ERPs.
Yeah. I can't think of any where there's only one.
Yeah.
Right. Not anymore. And there might be, but then they're so niche that, you know, we wouldn't have heard of them, and it's a very different scenario. But they're commoditized, right? Which means they're also homogenized. And this is where small businesses, unique businesses go to die. And you think if a business starts up, and this is what you were saying earlier, and what I referred to as the superpower, right? So this is what you were saying about these businesses have their own processes and their own ways of doing things, right? That's their superpower. That's their differentiator. And I think, I don't know, I'm thinking back to that, the book, The E-Myth, right? And, you know, you do want to productize and you want to kind of make everything as efficient as possible, but not what is your unique thing that makes your business, right?
But you want to bottle that, right?
Of course you do.
You want to bottle it up and you want to be able to reproduce it and sell it.
But you want to bottle that. You don't want to resell someone else's bottles, because everyone else is reselling someone else's bottles, yes, as well.
Exactly. And I've got that. That's one of my notes that I wanted to talk about, right?
Yeah.
And this, I think this is a very critical thing, is if you're not encoding your, like you said, your superpower, you call it superpower, I call it secret sauce, right?
Yeah.
Same thing. If you're not encoding that and you're just grabbing one off the shelf, so is your competition.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you can't stand out.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is, you know, one of the important things here that I mentioned in this article. So earlier on, you spoke about one of the costs of these projects is you've got the millions of dollars in license fees and then the millions of dollars of customization, right?
Yep.
But the reality is that millions of dollars of customization is really what actually happens. You get a bit of customization, but what you get is, you get the reverse, right? You get the homogenization, because all of that organizational change management and all of the process mapping and all of the change management and the planning and everything else, it's not into the software, it's into the business. Yeah. And what happens is these large consultancies come in and they tell you how you change your business to use this new software product that you're purchasing.
I was going to say, don't you have an anecdote based on that?
I do. I'm pretty sure I mentioned it in here. I'm not sure if I can name the company, but I mean,
The anecdote that I recall you saying is basically exactly what you said, right? The company sold the product with consulting fees. You were under the assumption that the consulting fees were to help adapt the product to the process.
Yeah.
From their perspective.
So it's a very, very well-known product. I mentioned it in the article. It's SAP, right?
Yep.
We didn't buy directly from them. We bought via another very well-known company, which was IBM. And this was a years long deal. And, you know, after it was, you know, once the kind of execution began in earnest, it was probably another a year. There was like several months, you know, 6-9 months worth of consulting and business process mapping that they did in our company. And they literally, they sat with all of our subject matter experts and all of our knowledge workers, and they made detailed business process maps, and they studied what we did in detail. And yeah, and our assumption was that was they were going to go off and take that and use it to customize the product to our processes. And what they did when, you know, at the end of this process was they came back and said, here's our training plan to roll out for how you change everything that you do to match how this system works. And I heard a joke that someone said that SAP stands for should have altered processes.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
And
again, if you're doing that, how are you preserving your superpower?
Your secret sauce. Yeah.
Your secret. Right.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's the crux of it for me, right?
Yeah, same.
And it again, this comes back to the rent versus buy analogy. If I'm buying a block of land, I can build whatever house on that land I want.
Yeah.
That suits my needs, that makes me unique, that satisfies my unique requirements, and it doesn't have to line up with everyone else's. Whereas if I'm renting a house, I get what has been available, what's on the market at that point in time. I've got to rent that.
Yeah.
And sometimes I need to make compromises. To sell,
if the owner decides to renovate, if the owner decides to put the rent up.
Exactly. But I'll need to make compromises, right? I might want a 4-bedroom house, but there's none on the market in my price range.
Yeah.
So I've got to go for a 3-bedroom house instead. No, I'm really liking that analogy. Like it's, I want to start encouraging people. And where I'm really positioning my business now is in that bracket of like, let's democratize custom software.
Yeah.
Like let's make it available for the masses.
Yeah.
For the people that don't think that they can afford it, that it's not for them. And
yeah, I agree. Yeah.
To be fair, right? Custom software it's a very broad term.
Yeah.
Right. A custom software piece of software could literally be writing an integration between two bespoke platforms.
Yep. Could be a script.
Could be a script. Right.
Yeah.
But it's more around identifying what that USP is for the business.
Yes.
Highlighting it and just building shit around that USP.
Yeah. And just to be fair about this whole thing, when it comes to buy versus rent, sometimes rent is the right decision. And often you might find for everything else that isn't that USP, rent is the right decision. And one of the classical examples I give is email, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to build your own email server from scratch. You could, right? There's an SMTP API in the base class library in .NET. Like you could build an email server if you wanted to. You wouldn't want to, right? You really wouldn't want to. But even like these days, no one even runs their own mail server anymore. I mean, of course, lots of people do, but the vast majority of us are moving to the cloud because it makes more sense.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of things. Like the other example I give is you're not going to rewrite Excel, right? You probably shouldn't, you know, and it's not necessarily that there is the one size fits all and there's the correct answer for everyone, for every situation. But the risk is, well, the danger is of falling into the trap of believing that there is one size fits all and there is one risk that's consistent across all scenarios and all use cases. And it's just not true. And, you know, like there are certainly cases where bespoke software is not the right thing. And I've used this example here before on this podcast before. There's been several times where I've done some consulting work with the client and said, I don't want to build this for you. There is literally this product that you can buy that does exactly what you want.
That's it. Right. And as consultants, I think like that's our job, right?
Yeah.
We want to, well, me personally, I want the best for my clients.
Yeah.
And yes, I enjoy writing software and I love solving those problems. And that's where I get my dopamine hits from. But at the same time, I don't want to solve problems anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The problem has already been solved. Do that.
Yeah.
But most companies' superpowers, and I'm using your word now, superpowers, I think I prefer that. Right? They're not solved. They're not things that are encoded. They're not things that are really...
So for me, right, here's the core insight into all of this. And I mentioned this in this article as well, right? I think that the whole homogenized, commoditized software thing is conflating the origins of enterprise software with the reality of the world we're in today, right? And the reality of the world that we're in today is that the bulk of individuals working for organizations using software are in, at least in this country and in the West in general, are in knowledge work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And enterprise software in general is born out of manufacturing. And there's a reason that in my article, I talk about ERP and ERP implementations as the benchmark, because the entirety of the commercial software model comes from ERP. And I'm not making that up, right? So if you look at the language, we use, bill of materials, purchase order, work order, pipelines, all this sort of stuff, like the language, the whole lexicon comes out of ERP. And like the ERP software that emerged, that became the foundation of large rollout enterprise software was ERP, which is fundamentally manufacturing, right? And the thing about manufacturing, sorry.
As a complete side note, is the poster child for domain-driven development.
Yeah, well, there you go.
That's what I mean. Like, you have domain terms inside your actual application in the end.
Yes, but now we use those terms everywhere, not just in that domain. And that's the problem.
Yes.
Yeah. And to, you know, just to put some perspective on that, if you think about manufacturing, right, your secret sauce, your superpower is not the software that you use for managing work orders, you know, supply requisition, you know, all this sort of stuff, right? Your secret sauce is, or at least was in the 80s and 90s, is the physical product that you are building, right? So if you're a car manufacturer, your secret sauce is your car. If you are Sony, your secret sauce is the Walkman, right? What have you. Like, if you can buy software, if you can, in fact, if you can homogenize your back office processes to a commoditized software system, I've just realized you're using your AdaConf pen. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. We'll talk about AdaConf in a minute as well. Yeah, like, it's actually a benefit because it's not your core business and you don't want to spend time thinking about, are we doing this the right way? Is there a better way? It's like, no, a consultant will come along and say, here's how everyone else is doing it. And it's the right thing for you to do what everyone else is doing because that's not the part of your business that matters. But when you're in knowledge work, the product is the process. And if you homogenize the process, you've literally removed your superpower.
Yep.
And it's the manufacturing playbook. And we're taking it and we're applying it to 2026, you know, knowledge work, and it just doesn't fit.
When your That's, product is your knowledge.
Like, exactly. Yeah.
Actually, I just realized what USP stands for.
Yeah.
So you need superpower.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So that's for me, that's the biggest risk. And it's like, you know, the risk is, and this is where unique companies go to die. And this is exactly what happens, you know, the disrupt we speak about, it's another aspect of what happens to disruptors. And we've spoken about this before. You know, disruptor comes along, changes everything. But what happens eventually is the industry rarely changes to adopt what the disruptor's doing. Usually what happens is they kind of orbit the center of gravity until they both end up at the center of gravity, which is a lot closer, which is a little bit off center towards where the disruptor is coming from, but is a lot closer to where everyone else was doing it before.
Correct. And I think to use another term with another topic that we may cover is that's when we start to see the enshittification of things.
Yes, it is. It's exactly right. That. Yeah.
It's where, you know, the likes of Slack, the likes of Atlassian.
Yeah.
They had really unique products at that point in time.
Yeah.
Then they start to become more mainstream. And all of a sudden, now they're actually going too far mainstream and they start becoming unusable. And the things that made them exciting to use, made them the right tool at that point in time, and now no longer relevant.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, they're mainstream. They're drifting back to the norm.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not to say they don't change the norm. They do. But the change to the norm is far smaller than the change that they make. So the two normalize, right?
They have to, they evolve back to the norm or devolve back to the norm.
The normalization is a lot closer to the original norm than it is to the disruptor.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I hate to say it though, but the advent or the introduction of the current AI tooling makes this a lot more approachable and a lot more palatable too.
Yeah.
Right. We've spoken about the downsides of renting your core processes and renting your core platforms, but the cost of building them is only coming down.
Yeah, that's true.
The cost of ownership is shrinking by the day.
Yeah. And, you know, the ongoing cost is usually a lot lower as well, but that's a whole. I mean, I've only got anecdotal evidence for that. And when I was researching this, I didn't actually research that aspect, and I probably should. I should probably put some numbers behind that. But in my experience, the total cost of ownership, the ongoing cost, is much lower.
Look, and I think that's really hard to quantify.
Yeah.
You need an accountant to be able to quantify that, right? Because then we're talking about things like amortization across the lifespan of the product. Yeah. And here in Australia, R&D grants and everything else that potentially could be of benefit to help reduce those costs.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, there's fancy tax and accounting mechanisms in place that can figure that out, but I can't help you with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think then we're agreed, like we're basically agreed across the board, which we were, this was never going to be a debate, an adversarial debate.
It's well, something that we've, I mean, playing devil's advocate there, right? We're both on the same team. So,
well, yes,
it's going to be hard to actually debate that, the other side.
True. Look, maybe we can invite someone to, I'll say it now, right? If anyone takes exception to what we've said and wants to come on and tell us why we're wrong, I for one, welcome it, right?
I would love to have that conversation.
Yeah. But I think we're probably both agreed that our mission is, as we said earlier, right, is to make sure it's our job as consultants to make sure everyone understands all the options, what the risks and benefits are, and at least offer them enough information and enough of our perspective to make the right choice. If they choose not to, that's fine. It's their choice. But I think the problem is that that choice is often either uninformed or misinformed in my experience.
Or, yeah, I guess uninformed. Like, they just don't realize that it's possible.
Well, uninformed, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think misinformed as well. And I think that, and again, I don't think this is through malice, but I just think it's the shared narrative across the IT industry that we've had for the past 2, 3, 4 decades as well. And I think that comes from, and I don't think that's, you know, I don't think, as I said, anyone's doing it from malice, but I think it comes from two things. One is that that is just the narrative and it's just not really being challenged enough. And the other is that, you know, big tech and big software and big ERP and whoever else are out there with an army of sales folks on commission pushing it and pushing that narrative hard. There isn't the same thing for bespoke software dev.
No, there isn't. But I think it hasn't been until relatively recently where the cost of development has come down. And the accessibility of being able to have bespoke development has come down, right? We've all, for the last 2 decades, we've had outsourcing, right? And yes, that's reduced costs, but that's come with its complexities and other expenses, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think it's around now, right? Where I think that it's a far more palatable and more accessible for SMBs to be in that space.
Yeah. I don't know if I 100% agree. I'm not saying I disagree. I'm just not saying I 100% agree. And I think evidence to the contrary, for example, might be the existence of several boutique bespoke software consultancies that we both know of that have been around for 30 years or more.
Yeah, but see, even their rates are still exorbitant.
Not all of them. Maybe the ones that have been around for 30 years or more, yes.
Right, because they, again, back to what I was saying before, and like applying that USP idea to our industry, right, they've been around.
Yeah.
They've built their reputations. They are the, for argument's sake, the bigger end of town where they can rely on their reputation.
Well, I mean, these particular ones, they're the big fish in the small pond, but there are also whales in the ocean as well, like you mentioned. Yes. Accenture, right?
Yeah, yeah, so, exactly, right. But the big fish in the small pond, right? They've still been around, right? They've earned, rightfully or wrongfully, the ability to charge and to command a premium price. And
they've earned the belief that they can.
The whole point of that poster that I put out, and I'm glad we're talking about it, is I want to make sure that people realize, one, that that is not always the case.
Yeah.
But two, give me a call.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Right? And three, give you a call.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we can cut that one because you're still employed.
Well, I mean, it is my job, literally. So give me a call.
I think like the big takeaway is that, yes, people, one, realize that it's possible. Two, realize that it's within their reach. And then three, realize that myself or yourself are the ones to do it for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. So that's our mission.
Absolutely. And funny you say that. Really funny you say that because I remember, you know, doing courses on, you know, like business courses and whatnot, and where they talk about when you're putting together your business plan, coming up with your vision and your mission. And I never could figure it out for myself. And it wasn't until probably 6 months ago that I started to really nail it down.
Yeah.
And it's the word I used earlier is the one I'm sort of really focusing on. And it's democratizing custom software.
Yeah.
Right. Making it available for the masses.
Yeah.
My mission, my vision is to see.
Isn't that what vibe coding does?
Sorry?
Isn't that what vibe coding is for?
Well, it is,
It is a part of it. It is.
It's a part of it. And that's my point, that yes, it is becoming more accessible because of AI, but and I've had this conversation with other people, right? You still need the experience and the expertise to know whether or not that AI tool you're using is doing something of sense.
All right. Can I just say, I don't want to cut you off, but hold that thought. And the reason I say that was because we were talking about what we were discussing what tonight's topic was going to be. And we proposed two different potential things. And we said that they were connected. And I think what you're talking about now leads directly into the next topic. So let's talk about that next time.
And on that bombshell. No, I think you're right. You're spot on right there. And I think let's cover that part next time, that enterprise side.
Yeah.
But still, you still need someone that knows remotely what's going on to make sense and make sure that your AI tooling is doing the right thing and doing something sensible. And now I don't know where I'm going.
Well, I'll tell you where I'm going in November. I'm going to Melbourne. And you reminded me because I spotted your pen earlier. And last week, the early bird tickets went on sale for AdaConf.
Oh, yeah.
So the only reason I haven't grabbed one yet is because they now have this unconference this year as well. So I'm just kind of in two minds about, do I go to the unconference as well, or do I just go to the AdaConf, the regular conference day? I'm still not sure. What are you doing?
Oh, that's going to be tough.
Yeah. And I feel this pressure to get it done before the early bird pricing ends.
Okay. I don't know if this makes it to the final edit, right? First things first, I may be doing a run in Japan early November. I still don't know what date that is.
Right. Okay.
I believe that is the first, it could be the first weekend of November. I'm not sure, because they only had last year's date on there, which was like the first and the second. And then this year, the first is a Sunday. So I don't know what the actual date is. And if that's the case, I don't know how long I'll be away for, which also then means even if I come back, I don't know if I can go straight down to Melbourne.
Yeah. Okay. So look, we can figure that out, right? So we can figure that out a bit. And I'm going to work backwards in time from there because there's some other things I want to talk about. So it is now, it's the start of May.
Yep.
And that means we're getting close to July. And you know what that means.
I'm going to play dumb here and say that I don't know that it means there is Maui UI in July.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Let's pretend you don't know.
Yep.
Yeah. So Maui UI July. So I don't know if anyone that's listening is interested in signing up this year and having a crack at a UI challenge, but I will say that this is unquestionably the year to do it. And I've said this before and I'll say it again, like .NET 10 that came out in November last year was a game changer. And it's just really changed things completely. .NET 11, which is in preview now. It is even better. So you know, like now is the time. If you've been tossing up whether or not to try Maui for years or whatever, now is the time. You know, like this is the thing, is if anyone had tried it before and said they didn't like it, I would have defended it and I would have said, well, it's a bit rough around the edges, it's early days, it's if someone tried it now and said they didn't like it, I would say fair enough, it's not for you. Like that is 100% where we're at now. Like it's changed, it's good. So I really encourage anyone that is considering it. And if you're not 100% sure, I've got some resources that can help. I've got a book, obviously, that you can buy, but I've also got a free workshop online that you can work through. And I'm more than happy to help anyone individually if anyone's interested in doing some Maui stuff. So ping me, let me know, and I'll put up a blog post about that in the next day or two. And then working backwards still now to this month, at the end of this month is Slash New, and that's on the 27th and 28th. So I'll be going to that again this year. I'm assuming you won't be coming. Yeah.
No, it's too much on.
I'll have to report back again like I did last year.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Good good lineup this year, actually. Good. Looks like there's some good sessions. So
yeah, that's just bring up the agenda here. The first talk, AI is like chocolate.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's some good, you'll see some familiar items on the agenda, or at least one.
Afternoon tea.
Yep. There's some
There's some good topics there.
There really are. If you look at day two, man, there's just some really, really great topics. But if you look at day two, 11:15.
Has Slash New always been 2 days?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the change is only good when it's measured. Yep, that was a good talk. Yep. I enjoyed that.
Very good talk. Yeah. So I absolutely encourage anyone that is I don't know. Are they sold out yet? They're not sold out yet. So anyone that's on the fence, I would even say it's worth going just for that one talk. But the rest of it is amazing as well. So if you are going and you see me, I'll probably have my Beer Driven Devs shirt on. So give me a shout. Come and say hi.
And goggles? Your beer goggles?
Yes, I will have my beer goggles on. Yeah.
Good.
I'll have some stickers to give away.
Yep. And unfortunately, I won't be able to make it.
Yeah. Look, that's okay. I will write your name on some stickers and give them to people.
I'm just looking at the website. Yeah. Looks like a good lineup.
Yeah. It really does. Yeah. Great lineup. Great series of talks. Yeah. I'm very much looking forward to it. I will either way, you know, maybe you will come to AdaConf, maybe you won't. I will definitely go to AdaConf /new. So I'll be able to at least report back on both. All right. Well, that was a very agreeable conversation.
Like I said, we're both batting for the same team. You're not really going to get much of an argument against. But look, like you said, I'm always open and happy to have these conversations. If someone wanted to jump on board
and tell us why we're wrong,
if someone wanted to jump on and debate the contrary to our opinions, I'm more than happy to have that conversation.
I think that'd be fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
But for now, I think that's the last drinks bell going off.
So I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs, Matt. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Either that or it's my tinnitus. For the record, I don't have tinnitus.
It's your middle-aged burnout ringing.
Yeah, it is, yeah. It's that death toll bell getting closer.
Yeah.
Creeping up.
That's it.